Welcome to MGO Podcast 12.10. Please do not Google a medical condition I reference early in this podcast. So, I feel like this is the point in the commercial when Lovely Day is playing, and then they're listing a series of side effects, including anal prolapse.
I was wondering how you're going to start this podcast.
is that inaccurate?
No.
Because it's like, you know, it's Lovely Day, and the song's playing, and everybody likes the song, and then it's like ominous undertones, kind of... Also, if you're interested in this commercial, things have not been going well for you health-wise.
Well, and also, like, that's the point of the commercial where you generally either get really tuned in or completely tune it out.
Because either the anal prolapse is relevant to you or it is not.
Exactly. And I hate to say which side of that we were on last night.
This is the MGO Podcast. I'm Brian Cook.
I'm Ace Sandbender.
I'm Seth Fisher and Disturbed.
Michigan wins 48-42 over Rutgers in triple overtime. And now that we've sufficiently distanced our sponsors from the opener of this podcast, why don't we tell people who they are?
Well, the MGO Podcast is brought to you by Underground Printing and the Bow Store. Check out Underground Printing for custom holiday swag for your business at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide. Our associate sponsors are Ann Arbor Elder Law, Homeshore Lending, Human Element, Information Entropy, Michigan Law Grad, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, the Residency in Ann Arbor Downtown, University of Michigan Alumni Association, and Fuego Box.
So, I think we're leading off with sort of general feelings, as we have to whenever there's a program crisis that is ongoing, and I don't think this really moves the needle much for me.
No, I mean it. I ended up writing in the recap, like, if you were ready for this coaching staff to go, then I don't think this game changes that opinion at all. And if you were one of those people inclined to give the staff as many chances as possible, then you go, hey, they'd at least found a quarterback, maybe, and showed signs of life, and a win is a win, and technically. And it sure was technically a win.
If you're one of those people saying that Harbaugh needs to win this game in order to keep his job, I think you don't understand probabilities if you are considering this a win.
Well, so, I mean, I think there's a different point of view that certain people need to have. Like, people on the team, the coaches... Like, a win is a win for them, and they're going to act like a win is a win, and that's what they should do.
Oh, yeah. But there's no problem with the kids celebrating in the end zone after, you know, right, winning triple overtime.
It's great to see signs of life from them.
But, like, when that bleeds over into, like, what commentary, how, like, what the state of the program is for people who are not inside the program and can actually say things that are accurate instead of saying things that are inaccurate because it's good for team building. I don't think this really changes the narrative. I mean, Vegas knew everything about this season, and Michigan still failed to cover against Rutgers. And then no point were they really in position to cover. So, I don't know.
And they could have lost outright if Rutgers, say, hits a field goal or calls the play they call on the very next possession two plays earlier instead of playing for that field goal.
That was the stupidest... So, they center the ball.
Yeah.
They lose 2 yards doing it, and then the guy kicks a field goal that's good, if they're on the right hash, or if they gained like 3 yards by giving the ball to Pacheco. Just coaches, man. They're just, I don't get it, man.
And at that point, I mean, we're all just hoping to be put out of, we're just hoping for a merciful end at that point, right? Because that's where I was at.
There are way more people watching this game, like, hate watching this game, because, like, hey, Michigan's going to, like, lose to Rutgers, or at least Michigan's going to be embarrassed by winning to Rutgers in this fashion.
Oh, Sicko's game of the year, without question.
Yeah. Well, next week is Michigan versus Penn State, so let's hold our horses.
Sicko's game of the year thus far.
Okay. I need to
come back next week for.
I need to recrop that picture so that Twitter shows it properly, because everybody posts it and it's all cut off. That's what I was thinking about during this game. I was like, man, people need to make this photo wider.
Yeah, landscaping the Sicko's meme so it properly shows.
It's important stuff.
It is. It's very relevant to us.
So I guess we'll do our usual two segments on football before getting to our basketball bigs preview. And so the offense story is obviously Cade McNamara comes off the bench, unleashes hell on the Rutgers pass defense, completes like 80% of his passes, hits a lot of short stuff, makes a bona fide read to score a touchdown. And, you know, I had some very annoying Twitter conversations last night because I retweeted Colin, who was talking about the fact that the quarterback isn't really that important in the context of the rest of the team, because the rest of the team is sort of a hot dumpster fire. And I still think that's the case, but obviously you're going with McNamara going forward.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he just, he hit, you know, passes quickly and behind what is quickly becoming a very makeshift line. You really need that. It was kind of frustrating because it felt like the play calling changed when they put him in too, so it's hard to get an idea of like, but... I mean, he, you know, Michigan springs a receiver wide open, and McNamara puts it on him with touch in a way where that's definitely going to be a touchdown. He's doing what they need him to do right now to keep the offense moving, and that's more than what Milton was doing.
I think a lot of people all kind of saw that play and go, yep, I've seen Milton miss that one.
Well, because he missed Bell.
Yeah.
In a similar situation, and so that's a direct point of comparison. I just feel like people are maybe getting ahead of themselves. I mean, we remember John O'Korn against Purdue, and I'm not saying that McNamara is that level of quarterback, but when you haven't shown out what you can do, nobody knows what you're good at and what you're bad at, and they can't pitch their defense at what you're bad at.
Yeah, we had some people saying, like, this is Michigan's best quarterback since I don't even want to say the name that entered my mentions. It starts with an H. Which means we skipped over Denard. I especially since Rutgers also basically started off McNamara's Michigan tenure with two coverage busts. I don't want to give. I don't want to go overboard in saying this is the answer.
I want to point out, though, that like Milton had some bad, like the sack that he took where they had the guy completely unblocked off the backside. That's one of those reads where you have like the guy blitzing has a safety lined up directly behind him. That's always a, you know, go to your backside read. And McNamara made that read the second time when they ran the pick route. And then they ran it again. He made the same read again. So that he's making better pre-snap reads than Joe Milton.
Well, also his rushing touchdown was a bona fide zone read where he read the end and pulled. So it's possible that the reason we haven't seen any reads in the offense over the past couple weeks is that Milton doesn't execute it consistently in practice, so they don't want to try it in the game.
Or Josh Gattis threatened to punch Jim Harbaugh in the face at halftime.
I'm going to go with my theory.
It's probably better for our, you know, future credentials.
Yeah, we're going to go with my theory. But, I mean, you also have Cade McNamara operating in an environment where the running game is doing something. And, you know, people are like, well, the running game is doing something because you know, McNamara is keeping him off. No, it's not what's going on. What's going on is that Hassan Haskins is breaking tackles, regapping, and playing an excellent game. Gets up to 19, 20 carries in this one, kind of seemingly establishes himself as the number one running back on the roster. A situation where I think, again, you have a clear leader at a position now, and you can't go back to just a platoon.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that both frightened and impressed me about Haskins' performance in this game is that he averages 5 yards per carry on the nose in this one, and I would say he ground out over, you know, 3 of those 5 yards per carry all by himself at the very least. Like, there was a lot of avoiding guys who got into the backfield, having to make jump cuts, or just carrying piles and spinning through tacklers for yards that he really didn't have any business getting. So I'm excited about Haskins' performance, and I mean, I've been a longtime Charbonnet guy, but it's time to say pretty clearly that Haskins has emerged as Michigan's best back. But it was a little concerning how much he had to do on his own.
Yeah, the reason it looked like that is the way that Rutgers attacks is that whole stunt defense creates like a big gap with one linebacker in it. And so what you saw a lot of times was him cutting against that, like that number 8, that middle linebacker. And the play has been there. Remember a couple of years ago, or 2017, Michigan was running like out the backside of their power plays. And that was kind of the same thing. The design of Rutgers' defense creates that backside cut, but Haskins was the only one hitting it. The other thing that happened around then is I think they just started blocking a little bit better. I think there was some terrible blocks earlier in the game. Eubanks, I think, had a terrible game. Filiaga had another bad game. Like, that was what was killing the run game, I think, thought more than anything. I don't think the backs... Haskins saw that cutback, but that cutback is part of the play.
Well, he's the guy who's hitting it, so he's the guy who's got to play. And then at wide receiver, I think Giles Jackson continues to prove that he's a real downfield receiver despite being a short guy. And Cornelius Johnson fumbles, of course, on the first drive, but other than that, had an outstanding game. Even broke a tackle on a bubble screen, which is not the situation you're expecting Cornelius Johnson to find himself in.
No, I mean, there's probably 4 or 5 guys in the receiver group that we would have expected to get a bubble screen before Cornelius Johnson, but he's a serious downfield threat at this point, and we've also got to mention, if we're talking about receivers, even though he didn't have much impact as an actual receiver, Ronnie Bell was so dang good at blocking in this game. I mean, he was probably responsible for a huge chunk of Johnson's and a couple other guys' yardage just on when Michigan finally started throwing some screens.
Also, he had the butt block on the slant touchdown.
Yes. He was very excited about that.
First time Michigan's actually run a pick correctly.
I thought, I don't know if he was impersonating Pat Fitzgerald, but kind of.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah.
I mean, he looked, you put together the Price is Right gif, and that's exactly what Bell was doing.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Which is okay. We like it.
I mean, it's celebrating a touchdown, good. Celebrating the opposing team's personal foul, less good.
We do have to mention that Michigan's 2-minute offense at the end of the first half was a traditional cluster. What?
I wonder where you're going to go with that. I was just waiting to see what you were going to call it because there were so many directions you could go.
It's a tradition at this point. So I think the standout thing is Michigan takes 9 seconds to call timeout after a complete pass with the clock running. And then they, of course, have a false start immediately before they set Nordine up for a field goal, which is from 53 instead of 48 as a result. Just, you know, you start with 2 minutes on the clock and you're settling for a 53-yard field goal on first down. So if you had managed the clock better, you are in position to actually score a point or two.
Well, and they only got into that position by, you know, the last hair on their chin. Sanders still makes a catch on the sideline and gets out of bounds with 1 second left to put him in position to kick that 53-yarder. That was just... I mean, I understand that when you move to a new quarterback, you're probably not going to all of a sudden get way better at the 2-minute drill when you make that change mid-game. But man, it is getting really exhausting to see just the same crap come up over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, this one was so bad that, like, at one point, one of the refs ran in to go tell McNamara something. And, like, McNamara had to, like, ask for him to repeat it. And then the ref backs out, and then they run the play while the clock is running.
They ran it all the way down at one point. It was like they were trying to kill it.
I mean, it's just a part of the program, right? That's what you expect whenever Michigan is in a 2-minute drill. It's every time. Like there was a 1-minute drill in the Minnesota game that went fairly well, but if you go back and look at it, it's like two completions against the worst defense in the world. So that stands out as the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. I mean, I to put this one up against this, I think this would probably be second in the as far as worst managed clock managed drives to the Indiana one a few years ago. I mean, this was...
Do you have a list of
these? This one was out there, man.
They all run together for me, man.
So then the offensive line, they're obviously very makeshift right now. Still have issues that make me think that once they get up against better defenses, this is not going to go real well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it hurts to miss Jalen Mayfield and Ryan Hayes again and to also make a switch at center, but I mean... Yeah, just to see Mike Dwumfor, of all people, I mean, just constantly in the backfield, it was hard to watch. It was hard to watch.
See, that was a sunk cost. And this is what I get for watching Rutgers and breaking down Rutgers, okay? I was prepared. I'm the only Michigan fan in the world who actually had, like, watched enough Rutgers to know this is
all
we
were all.
Do.
I think we were all prepared for the guy that Michigan let go at DT to totally mess up Michigan's offense. So that was absolutely something I expected.
I'm just saying that's the design of their defense is they just fling those guys upfield, and then the nose tackle just kind of, like, crosses the kind of jumps across the center, which, by the way, on the 4th and 1, that, like, Filiaga just doesn't even block the guy. Like, that is the design of their defense. That's the one thing you should have been practicing all week is that exact block.
I mean, are you confident that all of the blocking mistakes that show up on UFR this week are going to be by scheme, or are there going to be some serious minuses handed out to interior linemen?
No,
because I have a guess.
That's not scheme. Having the nose tackle who's just supposed to go across the line of scrimmage, getting around you like that on the 4th and 1, that is 100% on Filiaga. That's like just Rutgers doing what they're doing and you not knowing how to block.
Yeah, and there's clear issues with stunts of any variety. So we saw that in the first game, except no, we didn't see it in the first game. We saw it every other game where Michigan just doesn't have a feel for where guys are going to come from based on pre-snap alignments. So... You know, as Ace was talking about Seth was talking about the safety who's over the corner, and that's like a dead giveaway for corner blitz. There are certain alignments in the front seven that heavily imply a twist, and it just feels like Michigan doesn't anticipate these at all. So, you know, it's a situation where you have a lot of young guys. You're starting a true freshman, so it's not entirely unexpected, but I was hoping we would see a little bit more progress than we actually did.
I mean, Carpenter is his first start, and he's a redshirt freshman. If this wasn't, you know, a Rutgers game in the middle of a wholesale program destruction, that would have been like, okay, I'll take that out of my redshirt freshman center in his first start.
All right, any other?
Yeah, I hate to say it doesn't concern me as much as a lot of the other areas of the offense, but or the team in general, but yeah, at least Ed Warner's still around.
Do we have any other offensive takes that we need to get out into the ether? That's a no. Let's take a break, come back, talk about the other side of the ball. It's November, and that means the holiday season is right around the corner. If you're looking for a unique gift, our friend of the pod, Underground Printing, is here for you. We love UGP because they provide top-quality custom tees and hoodies at affordable prices. Plus, their expert staff makes the design process simple. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holidaygiftguide and use the promo code GOBBLE27 for 27% off your next purchase. That's GOBBLE27, like a turkey.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go! Let's go!
Underground Printing is proud to present The Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
Here's a thing people say. Seth, tell me about your insurance.
I'm actually glad you asked me about that because I just changed my insurance and I'm really happy I did.
Let me guess, you use Phil Klein and Owen Rosen of the Phil Klein Insurance Group.
They are MGO blog readers and they don't advertise during football games.
And they've got a 5-star rating on anything you would care to see. Call Owen at 248-682-7445 or visit them online at philklineinsurance.com.
Win or lose this season, stop in to Information Entropy and make sure that you have a good time on game day. First-time customers can light up a free pre-roll and enjoy the quality cannabis products that this shop has to offer. Located 2 miles away from the Big House and accessible to ages 21+, find Information Entropy at 1115 Broadway, across from the Kellogg Eye Center off Plymouth Road. They don't want to hear the words go green over there, but they are happy to help you smoke it. Check them out at Information Entropy.
I need them to be so hot they can melt the One Ring.
I don't know why I went right with the Lord of the Rings theme.
Hotter than the pits of Sauron.
Doom, yeah.
What was the mountain called again? The Mount Doom.
Socially functional human being.
Oh, well, I guess I have to watch the movies again. Anyway,
Seth, your hottest take. Tennessee should have hired Greg Schiano.
Oh, man. That was a zag when I expected a zig, to be sure. But
I think Rutgers actually, you know, has improved immeasurably this year. And meanwhile, Tennessee is 15-15 under Jeremy Pruitt. They've lost their last game, 5 games, by double digits. And they have a good chance of losing to Vanderbilt next week.
You know, the only thing there is that I feel like cultural fit is an important thing for the program. And I don't think Greg Schiano is the kind of person who would drink whiskey with a dog.
Okay, but he also was going to bring Ryan Day with him as his offensive coordinator if he went.
Okay, now we're talking.
I'm listening at the moment.
As well as several other members of Ohio State's current staff. So that would have been a good move for all involved, except for Rutgers. But
all right,
Ace, I need your hottest take.
If neither team is above 500. A game should not be played before or after noon on Saturday. Like, if you want to make it a night game, make it, I don't know, like a Friday game or a Thursday game or a Tuesday game for all I care. But making Michigan Rutgers a 7:30 p.m. kickoff on Saturday, I would have been upset if it was 3:30 and they put it as a friggin' primetime game and then it went into triple overtime.
That was 4.5 hours lost.
Everyone who's not a Michigan fan thanked them for having it be the late game.
Well, I mean, the sickos, jerks. They still could have done the whole Schadenfreude thing in the middle of the afternoon. There was plenty of time for that. It wasn't a particularly busy college football slate.
I get the fact that, you know, watch Michigan step on its dick is a good idea for ratings purposes.
Yes, but like Ohio State Indiana was like that was a legit top 10 matchup. Put that in prime time.
I guess.
Why is Michigan Rutgers the Big Ten primetime game?
All right, here's my hot take. Michigan men are fine if they exist.
The caveat is important.
Is this a Brady Hoke is better than Brady Hoke?
No. This is the idea that because Ward Manuel has hired Juwan Howard and Mel Pearson as his two big coaching hires thus far in his tenure, that he'll go after a Michigan man in the event of a head coaching switch in football. Now, there's a big difference in both of those coaching searches. In the basketball coaching search, John Beilein left after everybody else had gotten hired up. So, you know, Oates was gone. Everybody else who is the hot up-and-comer had already been hired somewhere. So you're looking at a coaching field where I remember when I posted about it, there were three guys that I was like, these guys are better than just hiring Yaklich. And one of them was Billy Donovan, who was not available. One of them was Steve Prohm, Iowa State's head coach, who, for whatever reason, never really came up. And the third one was Juwan, because we had the idea that he might be able to do this because, in part, he went to Michigan and he has a connection with the program. Also, you know, he was a guy getting NBA head coach interviews.
Yeah, he was like one more season away from the NBA, probably bringing him up to the head coaching ranks.
Also, a member of the Fab Five. Like, we're talking about an extremely prominent member of the Michigan community.
And a dude that everybody loves, and everybody knew that before Michigan hired him. So, I mean, he had a 20-year NBA career, and like the last six of those, he wasn't playing, right?
No, he was an extra right. assistant coach for like the final third of his NBA
career. There were a lot of reasons to believe that Juwan Howard was a guy who could be a success at Michigan. And then with Mel left for Michigan Tech, where he was the head coach for 5 years. He got two NCAA bids, and those were the first bids that Tech had gotten in 30 years, literally 30 years. So he's a guy who didn't just stick as an assistant and hope to take over when the time came. He actually went out and proved himself, and Michigan hockey fell off at about the exact moment that Mel Pearson left. So that hire made a ton of sense, and obviously we're kind of seeing the early returns of that, especially because we have this elongated recruiting cycle for hockey. But he was the logical hire. And if you are familiar with the program, if you have established yourself as likely to succeed, then having familiarity with the culture of Michigan is positive, but there's nobody out there for football.
Scott Loeffler.
He's currently the worst MAC head coach, which is Brady Hoke was the best MAC head coach when San Diego State hired him. So
best former MAC head coach. Yeah.
So there's just nobody who's even vaguely plausible. So I don't think the threat, and it is a threat, that Jim Harbaugh would be replaced by some other Michigan affiliated person,
Nick Sheridan,
is realistic, because there's no realistic hire out there. Instead of Juwan and Mel,
Northwestern's 72-year-old defensive coordinator,
Juwan and Mel were the best choices, and I advocated for both of them because they were the best choices. But I won't advocate for a Michigan football head coach who went to Michigan, because there's literally no coaching tree.
Resurrected corpse of Bo Schembechler. No, actually, that's a bad idea.
There's a couple of reasons I think that would be a bad idea. First of all, the smell.
You know,
corpses, you know, tend to give up.
Mike Hanquist's name has come up in like the last three searches, and then we've been turned down because he was too old. It's incredible that guy is just still going. Like, he's the same age as Dierdorf and Brandstetter.
Well, maybe one of those guys could be the head coach.
Thank you for steering us back on track, Seth.
He played on the same line as them.
Any thought about like how good the football team is. Let's hire based on how funny the full cast is going to be.
I mean, we're already basically doing that. We might as well lean into it.
All right, if you would like us to continue doing this extremely silly segment, get some Fuego Box. Fuego Box will send you three hot sauces every month chosen for flavor, not merely heat. Go to fuegobox.com/mgoblog for $10 off your first month. And now, we turn to the defense. Does someone else want...
That was properly foreboding.
God. So, does anyone have Noah Vedral's stats up, Ace?
Yeah, I do, unfortunately.
Let's hear about them.
So Noah Vedral in this game goes 29 for 43 for 378 yards, which is over 8 yards an attempt. 3 touchdowns, and the only interception he throws comes on the final play of the game, so it's not really on him at that point when it's desperation time. His previous career high in passing yards was 252. That was last week against Illinois, who sucks, and he averaged 7.4 yards an attempt. Previous yards per attempt he posted this season, 5.1. 3.8 and 5.8. And if you go back to what he did with Nebraska or UCF, it's all bad. It's all bad. This is by far the best game he has had in his collegiate career, possibly better than anything he did in high school.
I knew when I put a sign over the guy, I knew he was going to have a freaking career game.
And you know who the number one culprit in that was? It was Dax Hill.
Dax Hill.
So he had the a first brutal game. Long he had a brutal, completion brutal game. That Rutgers had, he tries to breadbasket a ball that he at least needs to break up and probably should intercept. And then he blows the coverage, so there's no free safety on a post route. Problem. You're in zone. Problem. And that's the second bomb that they hit. And then he just kind of feels disinterested and isn't really doing what he needs to be doing. He gets beat on a slant, I think, in this game, which is like, uh-oh.
I mean, I'm coming back to the fact that Bob Shoup is not coaching right now, so I don't know who's coaching the safeties, but I think it's like some graduate assistant right now. And I don't know what's going on there, and we can't really, say whose fault it is, because it could just be a COVID thing or whatever. But whatever the reason, he's not getting coached. And you can tell he's not getting coached.
Well, he looked pretty good previous to this. I don't know if it's really on Dax Hill in specific. I mean, obviously the plays here are on Dax Hill in specific, but given what we've seen from the rest of the defense, just vacating zones, being nowhere near receivers, in man, in zone, I feel like this is probably still a symptom of a larger problem, which is exactly what you said. So I probably didn't need to say that again, but I did.
Yeah, I mean, the people I lean on a lot for, like, when I'm trying to learn to try to pretend to be a coach, or at least say coachy things, are mostly defensive back guys, either former defensive backs or people who coached it, and they think Dax has been not very fundamentally sound all year. He's been making up for it because he's got Dax Hill talent, but like, he's been doing a lot of these things the whole season. You know, he's missed the interception at the end of the game. He's missed that twice this year.
Yeah, and it's very much is what it is kind of situation. Hawkins goes out. Hunter Reynolds comes in. Hunter Reynolds actually might be better than Hawkins. He got over the top of a slot fade, which I have not seen a Michigan safety do ever. So that's impressive anticipation, because he's not the fastest guy in the world, or he wouldn't be a walk-on. But he's a guy who I thought looked much better than I expected.
Yeah, no, it was nice to see Reynolds come in and not only tread water, but maybe be an upgrade. And honestly, I thought the cornerbacks were decent. Like, I mean, Jamon Green had his ups and downs, but they threw at him a lot, and he was generally in position, making plays on the ball, doing what we've seen out of him for at least the last couple games. And Vincent Gray was kind of not noticeable in the passing game.
No,
they didn't really go at him.
They got a couple of slants under him, but that's going to happen to any cornerback without inside leverage.
And then McGrone goes out because this season is final destination for anyone with NFL prospects on the Michigan team. So Adam Shibley comes in. That goes okay. Like, Michigan really bottled up Rutgers' run game, which is not something that is like, ooh, let's throw a party. But it is something, especially when you have a couple of key players out.
Yeah, Josh Ross needed to have a good game to avoid the science circle on the charts. And it's, I don't think we're, I mean, he had some good plays at the end. He had the sack, and then he got out there in overtime when they had a pick play designed specifically to beat him. And that really set up that at stop in the, I think it was the second overtime. But he's a, he was picked on a lot.
It wasn't the second overtime, because second overtime was the throwback screen, but probably the third.
Yeah.
That's okay. It was a long game.
That one was on Barrett, though. That one was on Barrett, and that was,
I mean, the way that was thrown, pulling the running back forward, that was going to be really tough to defend. So, you know, all credit to Rutgers for not running that when it would have won the game.
Yep.
And then we see the defensive line doesn't have pay again. Kemp looks pretty functional as an anchor. I mean, that's probably where he should have been playing if Michigan had any options on the interior the last couple years. Picks up a sack, if I'm correct. That was actually like a pretty badass rush. And Hinton looks pretty good. Like, I know we're talking about Rutgers' offensive line here, and they're very makeshift, but we've seen Michigan go up against Michigan State, go up against Indiana, a couple of fairly makeshift lines themselves, and not perform to this level. So maybe a flash of hope on the interior.
Yeah, for what it's worth, Kemp was not credited with that sack. Michigan had two, and they gave one to Ross and one to Hinton.
Yeah, that was the one. That was the Hinton play where he just kind of, like, he was in the backfield like Willie Henry.
Hinton also beat a block on that one, which was nice to see a flash from him. And, you know, this was the best performance that a team has put up against Rutgers rushing offense since Michigan State in the opening week. Michigan State did actually manage to shut down Rutgers' running game. It was just everything else fell apart in that one.
Also, yeah, the sorry to interrupt you there, man, but like the Michigan rushed three on like the last play, you know, before overtime. And if Ben Van Sumeren actually gets depth on his drop, like there's four guys around that pass, and there's nowhere to put the ball because they only rushed three and Hinton actually got through. So, like, that's another good thing for him, another bad thing against the coverage, I guess.
Oh, it is what it is. So, we've had some positive notes about many places on the defense, but still the Vedral stat line comes back and just puts a big F-minus on the whole performance, right? You gave up 35 points to Rutgers in regulation, and none of that was short field stuff. None of it was defensive. They didn't get any explosive plays from their special teams. They just moved the ball.
Nope, they averaged 5.7 yards per
play. So, not really changing what we expect the rest of the season, I guess, the triple overtime victory against Rutgers. What do you think the line is going to be for Penn State? That's going to be insane. We're going to be a dog to an 0-5 team.
Did they just pull it off the board for being too disgusting for anybody to bet on?
I mean, this is a team that outgained Indiana by like 300 yards, which is not what we did against Indiana.
Before we hit big picture, should we cram in some special teams takeaways since there was some special teams happenings in this game, to say the least? Giles Jackson can run fast in a straight line. We learned that when Rutgers pretty badly busted.
So I just want to point out that he caught that ball at the 5-yard line, and he ran 95 yards in like 11 seconds in full pads.
He is real fast, and Rutgers also put up real little resistance to him running real fast.
There was one block we should call out, and that was Blake Corum, who also accelerated like crazy from about the 15-yard line.
It was on the kicker.
Yeah, it was on the kicker. I'm just going to put that out there. I mean, it was impressive that he got to him, but that was the first guy who really needed to be blocked. And then you also have some interesting kicking stuff. Michigan misses Cameron Cheeseman.
Yeah, but the other one was not a snap issue. So the other two actually were not snap issues.
Yeah, I was about to say there were three. I mean, the 49-yarder you can kind of understand pushing it, but pushing a 35-yarder in overtime, rough to see Nordine not make that correction.
I mean, I don't know what the I don't know how kickers work, right? I don't know how to, like, you know, I don't know their levers or whatever they use for their terminologies, but like it seems he's trying to bowling it, like he's like trying to like make it curve in instead of just kind of kicking it at the.
You just did the insane clown posse song for special team.
Talking about my homies. That's the only other ICP song I can think of.
I can't think of any.
I was about Except, to say, you know, I got none.
There was a commercial for years for like their Faygo baths or whatever they call their big things. Like there was a commercial that was on YouTube for years, in early YouTube, where like they're singing "Talk About My Homies."
That actually is familiar to me because I think they ran it during hockey games because it was like, "See ICP, it's something else Mike Ilitch owns," because those are the only commercials on like Fox Sports Detroit for hockey.
Hockey fan ICP crossover, I think, is, you know, not small in Michigan.
You really could have gone either way with that one. Zach Brown Band. Why don't you see Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat at the Fox Theater? Or Showboat? Anyway, let's stop talking about football.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of Homeshore Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homeshore Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our complicated loan. Brian used them. You should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homeshorelending.com. That's H-O-M-E-S-U-R-E lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
Passion for e-commerce.
Sell stuff online.
Security. Performance.
Conversion.
Beautiful user experiences.
Belle expérience utilisateur.
Monthly marketing.
PPC SEO.
Make your user a customer.
Conversion.
Eau de Parfum for online retailers. Love your website. Let Human Elements show you how. Available at human-element.com and find department stores, not find department stores.
This is a special message from our friends at the Residence Inn, Ann Arbor Downtown. All of our best to the MGO Blog family, and a special thanks to the medical community, healthcare workers, emergency personnel, and all essential workers that are keeping our world going. We miss you all. Hope everyone is staying safe, healthy, and home.
It's November, and that means the holiday season is right around the corner. If you're looking for a unique gift, our friend of the pod, Underground Printing, is here for you. We love UGP because they provide top-quality custom tees and hoodies at affordable prices. Plus, their expert staff makes the design process simple. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holidaygiftguide and use the promo code GOBBLE27 for 27% off your next purchase. That's GOBBLE27. Like a turkey.
I did it all for the money, Lord. That's what it seems. Well, in the world of night terrors, it's hard to dream. They hollering cash rules everything. Let's call it cream, cause when it rises to the top, you get the finer things. Ocean fronts rolling blunts with model chicken saying grace over lobster steak. Like, please forgive us for riding business with camera plates. Too busy looking backwards for jackers to pump my brakes. For help sign to symbolize the lie that hunger takes. Addicted to the green, if I don't ball, I get the shakes. I give it all for a peace of mind, for heaven's sakes. My heart's so heavy that the ropes that hold my casket breaks. Cause everything that wasn't for me, I had to chase.
They told me that the ends won't justify the means. And he told me at the end, it won't justify the dreams that I've had since a child.
It would have been our life. It would have been our world.
This is our world.
So better than Jeremy Pruitt.
All right, stop. We're going to talk about basketball starting now. And now we're talking about basketball.
I have no idea where the in-between stuff ends and the actual segment begins on this one.
That's a call for Seth. But now we are talking about basketball. We're going to talk about the bigs. We're designating Brandon Johns as a big for purposes of spreading out the number of players in each segment. But also, He projects to be potential small ball big, which is going to be very important because the other two bigs on this roster are emphatically not switchable.
Yeah, so, I mean, the one returner you start out with is Austin Davis, who was or returner as a true center, I should say, is Austin Davis, who, I mean, really surprised us last year with his post game. He almost made 70% of his twos. He was 52 for 75 on two-pointers last year.
Didn't he make like 19 of 20 at one point?
He had a pretty scalding hot streak in there. I cannot remember the exact numbers, but he made over 75% of his shots at the rim. And while some of the a decent number of those were putbacks and garbage buckets and whatever, a good 35% of those were not assisted. So those are him actually backing down and breaking down the defense. And he can do that. He's a decent offensive rebounder. Defensively, leaves a fair amount to be desired, including on the boards. He's just not a particularly good athlete. You know, he's the floor guy for this team. If worse comes to worse, you can put him out there, get some post buckets, have somebody who knows the system, and, you know, at least is going to be generally in the right place on defense.
He is listed as a forward on Michigan's roster, we should point out.
We everybody is except Hunter Dickinson.
Except Hunter Dickinson, right. So they do have centers. That was the first thing I wondered. But like they, I guess you have to be 7'1" now to be a center at Michigan.
Yeah, it's you must be this tall to ride kind of a deal.
Maybe you have to be taller than Juwan. Maybe that's the deal.
I mean, Juwan was a 6'10" power forward, so. He considers anybody when he was in the NBA, unless you were 7 feet tall, you were a power forward. So that's how it is.
Austin Davis is literally named Big Country. He has to be a center. There's just no.
I mean, obviously he's not going to play. I guess Michigan did occasionally play him at another position last year, but we won't see any Teske. Teske's comp, but we won't see any Dickinson Davis lineups, I don't think, unless things get real weird this season.
It does give you an opportunity to make a ridiculously huge lineup, though.
They can do that without putting Austin Davis and Dickinson on the floor at the same time.
Franz Wagner is as tall as Austin Davis. I mean, girth is a different story, but, you know, height-wise, pretty much right there. But speaking of putting enormous lineups out there, if Michigan wants to go with the biggest possible option, that is freshman Hunter Dickinson, who was a high four-star recruit. Michigan beat out Duke for him, among other prospects. I just went back and watched some of his high school tape before we recorded this. He's got one of the big frustrations with John Teske was that he didn't really know how to use his size in the post to score. That is not going to be a problem with Hunter Dickinson. He knows how to leverage his body, lean into guys. He has beyond a rudimentary post game already, and he's got decent offensive skill. He's got some 3-point touch. I don't know if we'll see that displayed much this year, although the reports coming out from Michigan's inter-squad scrimmage is that not only did he have 17 points, but one of those came off a 3-pointer. So there is some indication that he may already be past Austin Davis.
We're still talking Teske level of 3-pointing, though.
Well, he developed that.
He's ahead of Teske a little bit.
High school career. So he is probably still on an improvement track there and may or may not be better than Teske now. We'll have to see. He took a bunch of like elbow jumpers and that kind of stuff. So it's not like he's just adding shooting to his repertoire. It's that he's expanding his range. So,
and his senior year, he was taking a decent number of 3-pointers. That actually fills a surprising amount of his senior highlights. Now, you know, highlights show the ones that go in. So
I did watch a full game of his. He was taking on Trevor Keels, and who's a wing, but I'm just, this is a good team that he's going up against, and he was at times dominant. He took on the number one kid in the class, who's like a beanpole switchable center, and just took it to him. In another game I saw it, he finishes with both hands. He's really good about sticking his butt in someone and extending away from them, especially when the ball moves on the perimeter. So if you kick it from the wing to the corner, he's going to get in post position there. So he's much more adept at demanding the ball than Teske ever was. So, you know, he's a guy who I think could be, I mean, not Luka Garza, because Luka Garza is a unicorn, but he could be like a young version of Luka Garza, where he's
he's got more defensive upside, I think, than Garza too, because Garza has the same athletic limitations, I would say, but without as much vertical explosiveness and probably 4 inches less height and however many less on the wingspan too. I mean, Dickinson is enormous.
Yeah,
and you can see he's got pretty decent timing on the defensive end. In terms of blocking shots, to flip back to the offensive side of the ball real quick, one thing I think also that differentiates him from Teske is that his shot comes out way faster. He's got a relatively high release. He gets it off pretty quickly. So that, I mean, because a lot of Teske's inability to translate his shot into the pick-and-pop game was just the fact that it took so long for him to get it off, that a lot of shots that started out open ended up being kind of contested. So you'd get these shots that ended up being sort of rushed at the last moment by Teske. That's not going to be a problem with Dickinson, because he has a pretty natural shot that he gets into quickly. He catches it high and he keeps it high. And when you add in the post stuff that Brian mentioned, there's a lot of both pick and roll and pick and pop potential for him. He also finishes with more force than Teske did. He goes up with two hands a lot.
I just want to withdraw my Luka Garza comparison, because I looked him up on KenPom, and as a true freshman, 122 O rating on 24% usage. Jesus.
Yeah.
Right.
So Iowa also gives you a very nice offensive environment to play in. So, yeah, I mean, Garza should not be the expectation, but I think somebody who, you know, can, you know, occasionally give you some double doubles, maybe. I mean, it really depends on how the minutes shake out, but I certainly expect Dickinson to, if he's not already passed Austin Davis, to pass him at some point this year whenever he's comfortable enough within the system, because the talent and the size is just too much to keep off the court.
I want to point out too, the left-handed shooting, if you're a center, you're not getting guarded a lot of times by people who've just been practicing on you all week. So if you're a left-handed shooter from that position, your muscle memory when you just see the guy going up is to go after his right hand, and it shows a little bit in his film too, that like they're going after the wrong side of him, because you know, you're used to closing out and just getting up there. You're not thinking like, oh yeah, I got to go to the opposite side with this guy.
Finally, Brandon Johns played about half of Michigan's minutes last year, pretty exclusively kind of a dunker, did have a couple of post moves, finished number one in the conference, shooting 64.4% from the floor from two on just 47 attempts. Decent three-point shooter, very good athlete, hasn't really found a major role. His usage was very low last year. And we're just hoping that it clicks, because there are going to be certain teams against whom the other two centers are going to be extremely bad matchups.
Yeah, I mean, the hope with Johns is that you get a pretty decent amount of time out of him as a switchable five, because Dickinson and Davis are both going to be pretty pure drop-only centers against the pick-and-roll, guys who are going to be kind of anchored in the paint. And when Michigan goes up against, say, Luka Garza or Wisconsin with their multiple stretch bigs, you're probably going to want to be able to have someone out there who can just switch through, or at least have the quickness to get out against shooters. Johns provides that. He's very active. He's athletic. I mean, I love what he does on the offensive boards. He's probably Michigan's best offensive rebounder by a relatively wide margin. finishes pretty well. He's like a 35% three-point shooter at this point. So, I mean, the idea with him is that you still get some rim protection with him. He had a passable block rate last year, even if a lot of that was kind of coming off the weak side. But hopefully you can switch 1 through 5 on defense and then also play 5 out on offense in a way that really highlights what your guys can do off the bounce, opens up room for your wings to take advantage of mismatches more, you know, get, you know, maybe like post up Franz Wagner or something like there's some really interesting things that they can do with Brandon Johns at the 5. And also, I mean, he may very well slot in as the starting 4. It's hard to figure out which one of the kind of 4 primary wings is going to be forced to come off the bench after Livers comes back. Because, you know, Shondi Brown is a guy who would start on most teams, but he's kind of the versatile piece to the point where maybe he ends up being the 6th man because you've got Wagner, Livers, and Johns out there at the same time. Brown is maybe more equipped to guard 2s than any of those guys. So there's going to be a logjam. The good news is that, like, if you make it through this gauntlet and get into the rotation, you're probably playing pretty well.
Yeah, and so what do we think the minutes distribution looks like here? Is that a tough question?
Yeah, it's brutally... I think a lot of it is going to depend on the matchup, because... I think if I had to take a stab at the starting lineup, it would be, I don't even want to do it because people are going to get mad because I think the closing lineup matters more. I think the closing lineup is going to be Brooks, Brown, Wagner, Livers, and Johns. I think their best lineup is going small, at least with what they've got right now, until Dickinson... whenever he has his breakout, but big men tend to take a little while to percolate, and Austin Davis is just, it doesn't give the ceiling that this team could have if they put out pretty much any other combination of players. I like Austin Davis and he's going to contribute this year because backup bigs are not easy to find. And there are also going to be matches where Michigan is going against teams with one or two traditional bigs where you need to use that guy more. But it is hard to figure out, like, the breakdown between Mike Smith and Eli Brooks is really difficult to figure out. Smith has more offensive pop. Brooks is the guy you want out there playing defense, as well, which is why I think he's going to be the guy when Michigan is closing things out. Figuring out the center situation is difficult, and then figuring out how you split up the minutes at the 2, 3, and 4 when you've got Eli Brooks and Mike Smith both capable of being off-ball options, and Brooks in particular being a guy who can also guard 2s quite well. Or you can go massive and have, you know, Franz Wagner as a 6'10"-ish 2 guard. and then just kind of rely on the fact that your defense is massive with Wagner, Livers, and either Johns or Shondi Brown. But I don't even want to take a stab at it other than to say that, like, the guys that I know are going to play, like, 30-plus minutes a game are Wagner and Livers.
That's it? There's nobody else you think is a lock for, like, 30? I think
Brooks gets close.
Yeah, I think he's going to get, like, 20 minutes at the 1 and then 20 and then 10 minutes at the 2.
Yeah, it's going to be very matchup dependent. I think we're going to see a lot of fluctuation from game to game. We're going to see a lot of, experimentation over these initial 5 games of the season, because Michigan really gets a nice slow ramp up before conference play starts. Because even NC State, their ACC Challenge opponent, is like around 50th in the country in KenPom in terms of where they finished last year and where they project this year. So that should be, I think, like, projected like around a 75% chance win for Michigan, and everything else should be a relative romp as long as they've kind of got things together. So we're going to get to see Howard kind of try out whatever. And I think we're going to see a lot of different lineup combinations in the first 5 games.
And Johns is pretty streaky too, so you could have like a 3-game stretch where Johns is doing his thing, and then, you know, when he falls off again, you go with somebody else.
Yeah, I feel like the way that Howard has prioritized length both in his recruiting and his transfer market activities. Like, I kind of feel like it's hard to not see Sean D. Brown as a starter at the three, and then that pushes Wagner down to the two. Maybe that's just not viable for whatever reason, but like, if I had to bet, your fifth starter is going
to
be Brown.
So then you're kicking Johns to the bench?
No, I mean, Johns can be your five in that situation. So Liver starts at the
four. Oh, so you're saying both Davis and Dickinson. I expect Juwan Howard to start a traditional center. I just think he's going to do that.
I mean, I think he's going to start Davis early in the season, but like midway through, like I feel like it's just going to be who are your five best players, and like maybe you're going to start one of your centers, but they're not going to be like a 20-minute-per-game guy.
That's why I wanted to talk about the closing lineup more than the starting lineup, because I think, you know, it's going to transfer from Davis to Dickinson at center, but I don't think that's going to really impact the way Michigan finishes out games and plays their most high leverage minutes that much, because I do think at that point, unless you're going against a team where you have to play a real large center out there, you know, if you're going against an Isaac Haas type or something,
right,
then Johns is going to be your guy, and you're going to have all of those wing type guys out there on the floor at the same time.
Yeah, and there are a couple of teams in the Big Ten. There's Purdue. There's Illinois. Like there's going to be some very traditional centers that Johns is probably not going to be a good matchup against because he's basically a four.
Yeah, you probably don't want him banging against Kofi Coburn, but that's what Hunter Dickinson is there for.
All right, we're going to take a break, come back, talk with Jamie about Big Ten things.
If you get in foul trouble in Ann Arbor or Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man on your bench. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul, the Michigan Law Grad, at 248-924-9458 or visit his website at michiganlawgrad.com.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages
approximately $100,000.
It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go! Let's go!
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
The University of Michigan was the place we all came together. It's where we pursued our curiosities and where we rallied around things that really mattered. The Alumni Association has now made it possible for you to reconnect with your fellow Wolverines around endless topics within alumni online communities. It's where you can join in the discussion or start your own on any subject from your career, identity, hobbies, or interests. Go to umalumni.com/communities and keep the conversation going.
Welcome in, Jamie Mack of JustCoverBlog.com. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm I'm doing all right, guys. I'm still shaking out the cobwebs. Of
staying up past my bedtime to watch Big Ten after midnight, but I'm ready to go.
So we usually don't talk about the Ohio State game for obvious reasons, but they were in a competitive one with the number 9 Indiana Hoosiers, eventually winning 42-35. We have a rushing Rutger in this game because Indiana rushes for negative 1 yards.
Yeah.
Michael Penix throws for 491 on 51 attempts. That is nearly 10 yards an attempt. Justin Fields throws 3 picks, and Indiana scores to get within a touchdown with like 10 minutes left, and they just can't close the deal.
No, they had 2 chances with the ball down 7, although the second one there was no timeouts, 47 seconds left. And they couldn't really move the ball in either of those possessions. But, yeah, they had Ohio State on the ropes and on the run for much of the second half. And the whole time I was like, if they pull this off, they're going to have negative rushing yards. This could be the most unbelievable result ever. It was all Michael Penix. According to Pro Football Focus, he had 305 yards passing while under pressure. That's, yeah, whoa. Yeah. That's the most passing yards under pressure in the PFF era, which is only about 6 or 7 years, but still. So that's now number one. And he knocked somebody named Pat Mahomes off the top spot. I wonder what happened to that guy. he was balling out, and that's really Indiana's offense. You know, they couldn't run the ball yesterday, but they haven't been able to run the ball for years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Stevie Scott and the whole rushing game is probably one of the more inefficient rushing attacks, I've seen for a team that is competitive.
Full credit.
Just playground ball, throwing it all over the place. Freifogel again had another huge game. You know, and frankly, they missed some opportunities, especially in the first half, where this game might have been more competitive before their comeback even started in the second half.
Yeah, full credit to future Michigan head coach Nick Sheridan, who only ran the ball with running backs 10 times in this game. So yeah. Very much a keep them honest situation, and they knew that they weren't going to move the ball on the ground, so they didn't try.
Right. I mean, Indiana's first like 3 or 4 possessions went nowhere in the game, and it was just like that's when they actually ran the ball with the running backs, and it was just obvious. All of Twitter was like, these downs are like being lit on fire. Stop handing it off. Just throw it. So everybody was on the same page there.
Well, at least it wasn't, you know, Indiana running out to a lead and then slowly losing it over the course of the fourth quarter. So it wasn't the traditional Indiana almost game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, I suppose. However, if you had told me going into the game that Ohio State would only score points on 5 of their 15 offensive drives, I would have taken it, and I would have been like, oh, my God, they might win this game.
Well, there were also 2 particularly brutal Indiana moments, the Jamar Johnson fumble following the interception. And David Ellis's fumble when Indiana was threatening to score late in the first half. He had a couple fumbles that were both lost. He's going to want that game back. And he also had a drop on a fly
route. Right, and that was right before that pick 6 at the end of the third quarter.
That was a huge
So there's really a not that alternate universe of this game where Indiana wins it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if you're – actually, it doesn't even matter who you are. As long as you're not Alabama or Clemson, if you're anybody else, in order to beat Ohio State, you have to play something akin to a perfect game while Ohio State kind of falls down to like a B-minus sort of effort. And I think at times we got that out of Ohio State, and at various times Indiana did look like they were playing an A game – you know, with Penix throwing it around, but they really didn't. You know, they didn't play anything close to a perfect game yesterday. They scored 0 points off of 3 Ohio State turnovers, where Ohio State scored 14 points off of Indiana's 3 turnovers. If you're going to pull off, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime upset, those have to be reversed. And, you know, we talked about the Ellis drop before the pick 6, but I want to go back to his fumble at the end of the first half. That end-of-half sequence killed Indiana. You know, he's going for a catch and run. If he just goes down without fumbling, they're going to have 1st and goal, like on the 5 or 6 yard line. They're going to make it 21-14. That might be the halftime score. Instead, Ohio State gets a turnover. And then, like, the one drive the whole game where Indiana just did not tackle well ensued right after that, and Ohio State went down the field, 9 plays, 93 yards, and all of a sudden it was 28-7. Even if the Buckeyes score on the ensuing kickoff after a hypothetical touchdown there, 28-14, just way more manageable in the second half than 28-7.
Well, Indiana blitzes and they play zone behind it, and I think that's the best way to attack this Ohio State team. And they were going to adapt. They were going to figure out what's going on and then have a drive where they were going to attack it. Oh, yeah. I thought that, you know, Ohio State adjusts. But Indiana was adjusting right with them. And I thought that was the most impressive thing, that, like, from the coaching standpoint, like, okay, now you think you're going to get zone. Now we're going to give you cover one. And then they had a couple drives with cover one where, you know, they weren't looking for it. They weren't prepared for it. It was a masterfully coached game, I thought, by Tom Allen on the defensive
side. Yeah, I agree. And, you know, you wrote about it before they played, you know, Michigan. Indiana just plays so many guys. So they could just keep coming at you with blitzes, keep coming at you with pressure from different spots. I think their defensive line actually played really well yesterday, especially Jerome Johnson. At times, Fields looked really normal. You know, he looked mortal, rather, at times. Then there were times where Micah McFadden had him down for a sack, and he escapes, and he scrambles for 30 yards down to the one-yard line.
Hey, Jamie.
I think at that point I tweeted a pox to Georgia football for letting this guy go. I think that's when I tweeted
that. Hey, Jamie, who's the leading receiver in the Big Ten?
Is it Tyler Freifel?
Like over 100 yards.
Nice.
Wow.
Well, in 5 games, he's already reached a career high in yardage. And just in the last 3 games alone, 25 catches, 560 yards for 6 touchdowns. That's 22.4 yards per catch in the last 3 games.
Yeah, that's a heck of a Freifogel. It's my favorite. Yeah.
And yet, you know, despite his effort, I bet today he's kicking himself for a 4th-and-2 drop in the first quarter that might have scored some points for Indiana. You know, just another example of where they played really well, but they just didn't play perfect enough. Pull out the upset.
Speaking about not playing perfect enough, Illinois 41, Nebraska 23. in a battle of sort of tangentially Michigan-related quarterbacks, Brandon Peters passes for 205 yards, 1 touchdown, 0 interception. Luke McCaffrey goes for 134 yards and 3 picks. I can see your problem right there. He also rushes 26 times for 122 yards. Illinois jumps out to a 28-10 halftime lead and never really looks back. They crushed Nebraska on the ground. They destroyed this defense while they were wearing their very anachronistic black shirts.
Yeah, yeah. You know, last year, I can't remember what game it was, they wore their black shirts in a game when they got destroyed. And it was like, well, it was pre-scheduled to wear the black shirts. You know, like, okay, might have been the Ohio State game. I can't remember. But they wore their black shirts yesterday as a reward for how well they played against Penn State last weekend.
What a glorious Scott Frost day.
Yeah. Illinois scored on 7 of their 10 non-end-of-the-half drives. They had touchdown drives of 89, 75, 75, and 65 yards. They also had a 16-play, 65-yard field goal drive that took half a quarter that was extended by maybe the most clumsiest fake punt I've ever seen. Did you guys watch that play yesterday?
No.
Yeah. Yes. It was beautiful.
It was.
It looked like a glitching video game.
Totally. I mean, he approaches the upbacks, and he's got just tons of space on either side. He doesn't know which side to go to. So first he's delaying there. Then he finally goes left. He's going to have an easy first down. And about 4 yards before the marker, he puts his foot in the dirt and makes a cut. And I'm like, what's he doing? Is he going to actually pump it off?
I guess you could call it a cut.
Yeah, right. I actually thought he was punting there for a split second. I was like, is he going to punt the first downs right in front of him?
I just watched it.
The dude looks so scared. Yeah. So scared.
Right. There wasn't even a Nebraska player, though, anywhere on the TV screen.
No, I mean, he was seeing ghosts. I've never seen a punter on a fake run see ghosts, but that's what it, like, the dude was seeing defenders that just weren't coming at
right.
him.
Right.
He comes to a complete stop, and there's one Indiana defender anywhere near him, and there's 2 blockers.
Nebraska defender. Hey, now.
Sorry.
Nebraska.
Sorry, I would never sully the name of Indiana football by comparing it to the
Indiana defense. Right.
Comparing it to the
I don't know.
By comparing it to the black-shirted Nebraska Huskers. Right.
I don't know how much time we're going to spend on this game, so I want to make sure I get some of this stuff out. But did you all see also yesterday after the game the Illinois official the official Illinois football Twitter account doing a little trolling?
Oh yeah,
actually thank Nebraska for saving Big Ten football for
one
the
of their
year.
Beat writers threw a hissy fit about it.
Yeah.
And then Illinois deleted the tweet. That's how much of a hissy fit Nebraska threw about it.
I didn't think I could ever be disappointed in Illinois sports, but them deleting that tweet disappointed me.
Yeah. No, stand your ground,
this
Illinois.
Game
come on.
Close with Nebraska a 16.5 point favorite.
Ooh,
wow.
Not good. I mean, Illinois, you know, when they beat, who did they just beat? They just beat
Rutgers.
Somebody. Rutgers, right. And their quarterback ran for like 200 yards. He didn't even play yesterday. They went back to Peters, and two different running backs went for over 100 yards, Chase Brown and Mike Epstein. And every time I looked over to this game, they were running outside. Nobody had the edge for Nebraska. There was no yards after contact because there was no contact. It was a bad, bad defensive performance. Illinois gained 70.5 of the available yards that they could gain after only coming in on the year at 43%. So it was not a good effort by Nebraska's defense. They hadn't scored a point in the whole first quarter this year, Illinois, and they scored 14 yesterday against Nebraska. They had 28 first-half points yesterday. That was the most first-half points since a little-known game in Ann Arbor in 2010 between Illinois and Michigan, if you guys remember that game.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
When your best defense is coming from your beat writers, your team might be in rough shape.
Bazinga.
And making matters worse, that one of their best recruits in the 2021 class is tight end Thomas Fedon. That's how you pronounce the name. He's only one of two ESPN 300 kids in their 2021 class right now. He's tweeting out that he's got a lot to think about. So,
that's always good.
Yeah, always good.
His other choices were Michigan and LSU, by the way. That was a Michigan
miss. A lot
miss
to think about.
That, we felt if he'd gotten on campus,
well,
we would have gotten him.
He picked some winners there.
LSU is still a reasonable choice. Moving on to Northwestern 17, Wisconsin 7, which is 42 fewer points than they scored against Michigan last week. Graham Mertz goes for 230, but on 41 attempts and throws three picks. No Wisconsin running back hits triple digits in rush yards. Northwestern wins a game with zero successful plays in the third quarter and 263 total yards of offense and 24 rushing yards. We almost had a rushing Rutger in a win, but not quite.
Going to the playoff, baby.
Holy moly. I mean, I'm not sure where I want to start on this game. Northwestern started the second half with five straight three and outs, and Wisconsin couldn't carve into the lead. You know, that
49 points.
Yeah.
49 points last week.
Yep. Between last year's game and this year's game, Northwestern's defense has only allowed 17 points against Wisconsin while facing 27 drives. So, in a way, last year's 3-9 Northwestern team, they were so bad, but they were in this game, so it wasn't a surprise that they were in this game as well. But, wow, they just took it to Wisconsin. Remember all those jet sweeps that killed Michigan last week? They ran two of those against Wisconsin. One, Patty Fisher just destroyed it, and the other one, their new defensive end, Ada Bawara, just sort of destroyed the left tackle, caused an 8-yard loss.
It wasn't just Patty Fisher out there.
No, it was a whole defensive team.
Northwestern had everybody flying the ball.
All
right.
Yeah.
You know, they've had good defenses these last couple years. They seem to have gone up a little bit of a notch this year.
Mike Hankwitz runs Bo's old defense. That's the Bo front. We've broken it down before.
Ace,
so.
I need you to pronounce. Yeah. Northwestern's leading receiver.
Oh, no. Ramad? I'm off to a good start. Chiao Kiao Bowman?
That sounds
good.
Yeah.
Ramad Chiaokio Bowman.
They were just calling him RCB. Let's go with that. They were just calling him RCB on the broadcast yesterday.
That's what I'll be calling him from now on.
He is a, I can't remember if he's a fourth year senior or a redshirt senior, but he had no touchdowns until he had three last week against Purdue. And then he added a sweet touchdown right at the end of the first half yesterday. And actually, those were the decisive points. And he is, his stats aren't like Freifogel-ish, if you will, but for Northwestern's offense, he's really been balling out the last two games.
All right, so Northwestern is a lock to go 8-0 and lose to Ohio State by 800 points in the Big Ten championship game. Because the rest of their schedule is...
At Michigan State, at Minnesota versus Illinois.
Yeah. I mean,
that might be the three worst teams in the Big Ten.
Because we're not on the list.
Okay, fair.
One of them has a win over Michigan. And one of them has some transitive wins over Michigan.
I was trying to slip that in and move on, and you guys you wouldn't let it slide.
Are they going to let Penn State and Nebraska rematch?
No, they will not have a rematch. Also,
yeah.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Right, totally. I don't see how those three teams move the ball at all on this defense. Northwestern's, they faced 59 opponent drives this year that started in opponent territory, and they've only given up four touchdowns.
Wow.
Only 0.65 points per drive on those drives. So, like, I mean...
Minnesota has an RPO offense, which is built to shred zone defense.
Yeah, and so. With Ibrahim and Bateman, you've got some next-level talent guys who might do some damage, but they closed down Purdue's receivers pretty well the week before. So, but I see your point. I see your point. As bad as Minnesota is, they're probably the one team out of those three that has a shot at winning against
Speaking of Minnesota, 34-31 over Purdue on Friday night, featuring one of the worst offensive pass interference calls you'll ever see.
Oh, my God.
Jeff Brohm was not nude, red, and screaming on the 50-yard line, so he's a better man than me. But right. Purdue mm-hmm. outgains Minnesota by almost over 100 yards. Not Jake Plummer, Jack Plummer.
Yes, Aiden O'Connell was
there. Yeah, they played Aiden O'Connell.
So they just throw out their other guy, and he throws for three touchdowns. David Bell goes over 100 yards. Rondale Moore gets 18 targets, 15 catches. David Bell should have had another catch where he rescued an interception, ripping it from the hands of a bereft Minnesota Golden Gopher, but they ruled that a guy was mm-hmm. touching the ball, standing out of bounds before Bell caught the ball, thus violating the number one rule of replay is one, if it's really cool, you let it stand.
Yeah, that was a technically correct but spiritually
incorrect. Did they overturn the
right
Penix
there?
Two-point conversion against Penn State? No, because it was too cool to overturn.
It was way too fun.
One of my hot takes that I didn't use this week was David Bell is better than Randall.
Honestly, I don't know how hot of a take that is anymore because David Bell is the truth.
So Purdue is kind of like the anti-Northwestern. You know, Northwestern wins all these close games year after year after year. With this loss, Purdue is now 7-14 under Brohm in one-score games.
I just want to point out that there were 65 combined dropbacks in this game and not a single sack.
Wow, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
You know, from the Minnesota perspective, as far as passing the football, it looked a little bit like last year. You know, I mean, six completions pretty much were like 75% of the yards that Tanner Morgan got. He had a couple deep balls to Ottman Bell and Bateman.
Yeah, if Ottman Bell kind of comes along here, this offense is going to look a lot better because you can't just bracket Bateman and be like, okay, we're done.
Yeah, yeah. And they had a freshman step up and catch a couple passes. I forgot to write his name down, sorry. But, I mean, exactly. There's some more going on in the passing game suddenly than Bateman.
Ibrahim goes for 102 yards on just 25 carries, which is low for him. Yeah.
Well, still scores three times.
He's now 10th nationally in rushing yards, and all nine guys ahead of him have played three or four more games. I think I brought this up a couple weeks ago when he was like 25th, and he still keeps climbing. I don't know if he can climb any more spots because some of those guys like Breece Hall have got a pretty big number. But, I mean, his season, I don't know if you could classify it as under the radar because Minnesota is bad, but this is like he's putting together an historical run here in a shortened season on a bad team.
Yeah. Speaking of bad teams, Iowa 41, Penn State 21. Penn State is the bad team. Featuring a pick six fat guy touchdown with a beautiful cut. Not something you often see.
And he switched the ball to his other hand, too. Like, he knew what he was doing.
Sean Clifford gets pulled in this game. Freiermuth, their excellent tight end, is out for the season now. Tyler Goodson gets 20 carries, only gets 78 yards. They actually get more production out of Mekhi Sargent, who goes 101 after 15 carries. And this was just really never in contention after the second quarter when Iowa goes up 24-7 and then just kind of chokes out the rest of the game.
Yeah, just a minor correction. It was actually Will Levis that started, and he got benched, and they put Clifford back in. So if you're reviewing, last week they started Clifford, benched him for Levis. This week they started Levis, benched him for Clifford. Who knows what they'll do this Saturday against Michigan. But Penn State running backs, you know, we 13 carries, 16 yards. Ouch, that's terrible. Yeah.
They're all gone.
They are all gone. That's what I was going to say.
Ford's the only one left, and I think he got 3 carries in this game.
Yeah. Yeah, they are that, you know, a year ago, they looked like they had one of the best running back rooms in the nation, and it's just been decimated for one reason or another this season. 5 games.
I mean, losing Journey Brown is like, that is devastating because he was really popping. He was going to be the best back in the conference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a great 2019. But even Noah Cain, I mean, Noah Cain, even as great as Journey Brown was last year, Noah Cain still emerged, you know? So like he's out now, they're playing 2 freshmen and neither of them were as nearly as good of recruits as Ford or Cain. So they're just a little depleted back there, and they have no idea what they're doing with their quarterback
situation. I gotta say something is that, so the composite ranks of the 3 tailbacks who got carries in this game are 79 overall, 281 overall, and 188 overall. So these are all high 4-star backs.
They still have
talent. And a couple of them are young, but running backs usually can hit very early. So I think there's something else going on just beyond the fact that they've lost some running backs.
Well,
are you suggesting that Penn State has offensive line issues?
They had a 4th-and-1 play yesterday where 3 different guys missed blocks and 3 Iowa defenders crunched Levis for a tackle for loss. It was as funny as the – not quite as funny, but maybe in the team photo with the 2-man rush by Temple all those years ago. And, I mean, that was all those years ago. Their offensive line still is mediocre at best year in and year out.
Yep.
Well, they brought in Shiraka from Minnesota. They tried, like, PJ Flex right-hand man to be their offensive coordinator, hoping to get Minnesota's offense last year. And I think that they're getting something closer to Minnesota's offense this year with their old offensive line, which is just the worst of all the worlds.
Jahan Dotson's really good, though. So they got that.
Yes, he is.
They've been down double digits at the half in every game this year.
Well, this is going to be a very resistible force versus movable object matchup next week.
It is. It's going to be a little bit of a, it's going to be a lot of a clown show. It's going to give the 2014 Penn State Michigan game a real run for its money in ineptitude. And boy, I got to say, can you imagine being a head coach in both those games?
Two ends of the Franklin career.
We need to get Dennis Norfleet back so he can teach Giles Jackson how to dance.
They should wear the jerseys for that. They should bring back the uniforms for this one.
No.
Just lean into it.
The Kanye Shades jerseys? No.
Have they announced the kickoff for this? Is there any chance this is going to be like...
No, they haven't yet. Do not curse it. Do not even suggest it. Do not curse it. I've already used my hot take on this, which is that games between teams that are combined below 500 should not take place before or after noon on Saturday.
So I have this to better mention be a noon kickoff. The game that we are referencing, the previous Penn State-Michigan game, was a night game.
Right, exactly. That's
I remember. And,
And Michigan fans got up because we were terrified that the players would all transfer away because we hated everybody in charge.
All right, the final game of the week, Michigan State versus Maryland, was canceled. So that's one more thing Michigan State has on us in this football season.
Remember how much fun we were looking into that?
Yes, Jamie, I do remember. God damn it!
There were so many things like that.
There are many things, many, many, many things we remember about earlier this season. Like when we thought our left guard situation in preseason was like, oh, I guess they have so many good options, they can't decide which one they want to use. Yeah,
that didn't work out.
You know what we didn't do in this podcast? Talk any hockey!
No.
Yeah.
Hockey was great. More mullets.
I will say this, though. I referenced the 2010 Michigan-Illinois game, and maybe you guys talked about this already, but wasn't the Rutgers-Michigan game kind of like the somehow some sort of polar opposite of it, but yet the same? Triple overtime, complete ineptitude.
It definitely hit on all the Harbaugh. Yeah,
backup quarterback comes in to save the day.
Right. All the list of all the great Harbaugh-isms, you know, clock management and, you know, why are you running into stack boxes? Why are you not scouting the other team's defense? Okay, we got them all in this one. We even had two moments of people yelling, do your damn job, or maybe harder words than that, which is like, you know, everything.
Well, this has been lovely, Jamie. Thank you for dredging back my feelings from before the Michigan State game when I was so young and innocent.
I know. We all
ran around with rose petals in my hands.
The last months of college football has put like 10 years on my life.
Well, at least you have Indiana.
I know. But now the hard part comes. The basketball team is going to
start. That's... Yes!
Tide's turn.
All right. Hey, what? Last question for you guys. Is Penn State basketball, hockey, or football going to get a win first this year?
I mean, football plays Michigan next week, right?
They do, but I think their basketball team plays this week, don't they?
Well, who are they playing? Is it VMI? Because other than that, I think they're screwed. All right, this has been the MGo Podcast. We're going away now.
Thank you for listening to the MGo Podcast. I am A. Sambender, along with Brian Cook and Seth Fisher. Sick Deke, Thomas Bordello. Nothing else happened this weekend. Bye. Sorry, we'll cut this part, but my mouse started moving, and it's because it's in the other room, and one of my children has it.
Ah.
So I have to go reclaim my mouse.